Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin, Belfast and Winston-Salem in North Carolina. Hooray, because we're joined by William Hinson. Hello, William.
Hello, fellas.
Now, William Hinson, you should know, is a friend of the show. He's a talented musician. He's just put out his latest single, Social Fitness, which is available in all the usual places, and you can track him down at www.williamhinson.com. But most importantly, he is a friend of the show and is our roving North America correspondent and resident young person, which is also explains why he runs our Instagram, because we just don't understand, do we, Stephen?
We don't understand.
But William has come to talk to us today because he has been to see the Beatles Get Back in IMAX, haven't you?
Yes, I did. I went yesterday. It was great fun.
So we're going to pick your brains and welcome to the show. It's nice to finally talk to you. And we've interacted a lot online, but actually haven't had any kind of reasonable conversation. So it's good to put it all together.
It's like a dream come true
for us too.
That's what everyone says, yeah. So as we speak, we're at the end of Get Back month, January, and there's been a lot of odd things going on because this IMAX showing has been happening. But I think the first thing we should probably talk about briefly is that the rooftop gig finally got a release. And I don't know about you guys, but I'm glad it wasn't in the box set.
I think it's really good it wasn't in the box set. I do not want a physical release. I don't want a CD. I don't want vinyl. How could they do this? Everything they do just makes the disappointment box ever more disappointing.
It is. I don't understand whether this is all part of some hilariously giant, well thought out plan, and that there's a 12-month slowly evolving Get Back window of releases that we're in the middle of, or whether it actually is an ad hoc, oh, we better put this out for streaming straight away.
The word you're looking for is shambles, I think.
Yes, omni-shambles. I don't know. What do you think, William?
Well, I was going to say, you know, the whole experience of the Let It Be sessions, the Get Back sessions, whatever you want to call it, was more or less shambles, no?
Yes. So you think they're recreating the shambolic nature of the original? Yeah. I think you may be onto something there.
It's performance art.
Well, up until the Get Back Peter Jackson movie came out, I think we were all sort of shrugging our shoulders saying, oh, Let It Be, is it doomed to be disappointing forever? The Let It Be box was a bit disappointing. And then Get Back comes out and everybody, universal love, universal acclaim. And in some ways it makes the musical side of things even more disappointing, that they didn't just climb a mountaintop and do something fantastic. And then if you're going down the route A of actually maybe there's a big plan, you can think, well, maybe there is now a rooftop gig physical edition coming and and some other tidbit extras coming as well. But then again, if it's ad hoc crazy Beatles land, who knows?
If there is going to be a physical release, I don't think there is no plan. I think Get Back took Apple completely by surprise. What we know from Get Back is from the Peter Jackson Get Back is these sessions were fine. You know, these were creative sessions. They had arguments, but they were getting on. They were pulling songs. You know, George is writing. Paul was kind of at the top of his game.
Yep.
But by the time the film came out, they'd broken up. It was tainted by that. The Beatles have this negativity about that particular period, those 4 or 5 weeks. They always did. They, right up to, Anthology is where George was saying, Winter of Our Discontent. Oh, this is terrible. This is awful. This is Klein. This was this. This was this. And the negativity around, I genuinely think Apple thought, we'll get the box set out. There'd be a film. We'll try and rehabilitate this, and then we move on to the next project. And then suddenly Peter Jackson produces this 8 hours of material. Everybody loves it, and they're completely wrong-footed because they're not ready with a response. And then their response is, we put the rooftop gig out. But then Giles comes on and says, well, there wasn't room in the box to put the rooftop gig,
But there was room for a EP that nobody wanted.
Exactly. And, you know, the whispers and the murmurs have been, and also logic would dictate that that EP was this replacement for a rooftop gig, you know? And if that's true, did, you know, the conspiracy theory is that Disney kept it out, or Disney wanted it to come out afterwards. I mean, I love this notion of, oh, they couldn't put the rooftop gig in because it would ruin the surprise, as if Peter Jackson discovered the rooftop gig.
Right.
Nobody knew. Wait a sec, how's this thing going to end? Everybody knew it was all about the rooftop gig.
Well, it's also like you're talking about the rooftop having its own individualized like release, like, you know, oh, we'll put it out on vinyl, or we'll put it out, you know, and it's a product in and of itself, but it's not long enough, in my opinion. There's not enough there to have its own individualized thing. And now they've introduced that as its own individualized thing with the IMAX screening.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's, I love Giles Martin. I love that guy. I think he is the perfect guy for the job. But his most recent interview with Rolling Stone, where he talks about there just wasn't, you know, it took up too much real estate. There wasn't enough room. And, you know, he says something like, I always enjoyed watching the rooftop concert more than listening to it. And it's like, okay, so is that not the... listening to it, is that not the same thing as like listening through all the session tapes from Anthology or any of these box sets? Like, why wouldn't it be included on the box set?
Yeah. I mean, they could put it on the same disc as the EP.
Yeah.
You know, they're wedded to this notion, you know, they had a 5 LP box, a vinyl box, and then they're wedded to this notion that, well, the CD box has to replicate what's in the vinyl box, but that is just to ignore one of the main benefits of CD, which is the space that it gives you. You know, they could have filled those CDs and put download codes in the vinyl box for whatever they hadn't pressed on vinyl.
Not to mention the vinyl box sets up until this box set didn't include the book.
That is true, yeah.
Yes, yes.
It's a good point about separating the concert from everything else, because, you know, before the Get Back Peter Jackson movie came out, the rooftop gig, it's not what many people might think, which is the Beatles live, in a similar way that, you know, the Beatles Christmas records are not actually, it's not like their Christmas songs, do you know what I mean? It's an experience that, you know, fans would understand. Now, putting it out after Get Back, you know, you could argue, well, there probably is more people that kind of understand it's not a classic live greatest hits type gig. It's a live event because they've watched this thing. And so they don't mind getting, you know, one or two different versions of Get Back and all the rest. So I can see why there might be a demand afterwards, but would that not just have driven the box? It's all just crazy. And again, there's absolutely no guessing what's going to happen next. And we might come back to this afterwards, because I know Peter Jackson touched upon some of these issues. But as a listening experience, I have to admit, I think it sounds fantastic. I listened on Apple Music, because that's where Neil Young is these days. And it was in a very nice, high quality format. And I think it sounds brilliant. And it's, you know, it does actually stand up as a listening experience. You know, there's lots of versions of it floating about, and, you know, you could argue, is it really something you'll go back to? But actually, it is something you'd go back to.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
Yeah. I've kept everyone quiet.
I was going to say one thing, because I listened obviously at midnight, because, you know.
Yeah, me too. You have to. It's just the rules.
Yeah, you have to, yeah. But I listened, and the thing was, like, I've watched Get Back, you know, a gajillion times now. And so it's like I've heard it, but there's always the visual aspect of it. And I felt like I was listening to a new product, genuinely. Like while listening to it, you have such a different perspective, because you don't see all the, you know, production assistants walking around with cameras and, you know, Kevin kneeling with the notepad. And, you know, it's like you're just listening to... you know, I mean, I've done live recordings, you know, and you having been there can visualize what happened, but then listening back to it and mixing it or whatever is a totally different experience.
And we haven't seen the rooftop gig, the whole of the rooftop gig, because we have people in the street and we have
people on the street.
You know,
sorry,
interviews and. you see what I have to put up with. You see what I have to put up with.
So we
haven't had a chance to just sit and listen or watch the rooftop gig, but you know, we have hindsight. Apple have people that should be able to predict and read the room, and I think they didn't read the room. With hindsight, what should have happened is they should have put Get Back, the movie, out before Christmas. Everybody would have loved it. We'd have had weeks and weeks and weeks of people talking about it and doing podcasts about it. And then they should have put the Let It Be box set out on the 30th of January. Think of the orders. Think of the, you know, people would have been so hyped up after the movie to buy this box
set.
There's
still the big desire. I think what you're both saying is right. And it's funny, you're both saying the exact opposite of Giles Martin's plan, which is, oh, you really just want to look at it. And actually, just listening to it is totally different. It is a very live and present and in-your-face type recording. It is spectacular that they pulled off the thing that they were trying to do, which is to go from not being a live band for 2 years to actually being able to pull off a decent half hour of tight, complicated material. That stuff, those songs are not particularly simple. They're quite intricate. When you pick them apart, something like Dig a Pony, you know, there's lots of rhythms going on there and lots of top-notch playing that I think, anyway, I'm not an expert, but that's how it seems to me. And they're doing it on a roof in the middle of January. So they actually fulfill their brief, and it is worth listening to on its own. You know, whether you stream it, and yes, it would be nice to someday get a physical copy. But I still have my theory that if you go to the Beatles website today, they have this thing that is, you know, Get Back the book, Get Back the film, and Get Back the music. But Get Back the music has a bit of tape over it, and the tape says Let It Be. And it's as if somebody could rip off that tape, and then you'd get a Get Back music box set experience. That's not beyond the realm of possibility, that a concert thing, because we also need our Let It Be movie, which we promised 3 years ago yesterday on the 30th of January 2019 that the Let It Be movie is coming. So there are still pockets of this that need to come out. But again, we'll come back to this later when we talk about Peter Jackson's Q&A. Did you know, though, that the rooftop gig that came out last week is still not exactly the whole thing?
I was going to ask about that, because that the thing that you posted on Twitter of the audio from the street, the track list has a short jam of I Want You, She's So Heavy.
Yeah. There's, well, first of all, that audio is amazing, isn't it? Isn't that
it really is, yeah.
So if people don't know what we're talking about, there's the YouTube audio, there's a YouTube clip up, which is about half an hour of the audio feed from one of the cameras on the street. And it answers the question of what exactly were people on the street hearing? And they were hearing the Beatles. It's actually very clear when you listen in the background that you hear them kicking into these songs, and it makes them even sound more live and more present. It's really strange where somebody's wandering around with a microphone and you hear them kicking off into, you know, I've Got a Feeling in the background. And, you know, there's a version of I've Got a Feeling at the end where, you know, John's voice is very loud. You kind of hear his harmony standing out on its own. And you can actually realize that anybody in the street below would have been able to pick out John's voice, Paul's voice. They would have known exactly. I'm sure there was a common knowledge in the area that that's the Beatles' office. But aside from that, it was really obvious when you listen to this recording made in the street that it was loud and it was them, and people knew exactly what was going on. Everybody they ask more or less says, oh, it's the Beatles, I guess, because it sounds like the Beatles.
There's one of the girls actually says, oh, that's Paul McCartney singing now. And then it stops in the background. She goes, well, that was Paul singing.
Yeah.
So, have you been to Savile Row, William? You were talking about having been to every...
I have been to the Abercrombie Kids me too. Savile Row.
Me too. I was shamed into buying a shirt because I was wandering around and they were kind of thinking I was a shoplifter, and I thought, okay, I better buy a shirt, tiny shirt for my nephew at the time. So
they know that when men of a certain age wander in and sort of look wistfully at the cornices, they know what they're doing.
The year before I'd been there, And the Abercrombie had temporarily shut down, and they were getting work done. And there was a skip outside, and there were workmen, and they were kind of, and I was kind of, hanging around. And one of the workmen came out, and I said, "Sorry, could I just?" And he went, "You can't get onto the roof." And I said, "Oh, okay." And he said, "Honestly, there's at least 20 people a day come up to one of us and say, would there be any chance of just nipping in and getting up onto the roof?" He said, "No, we can't let you onto the roof." So.
I think there is a market in London for some Beatles tourism. Like, you've been to Liverpool, William. I know that as well, haven't you? Listeners, there's a tiny bit of Beatle tourism in Liverpool, just a smidgen. There isn't really any big, like, there's lots of Beatle landmarks in London, but there isn't a Beatles museum. And Savile Row, a Beatles museum in 3 Savile Row would be great, where you end up your tour on the roof, looking out across where the Beatles were. I'd pay for that.
The building is empty. Abercrombie for Kids has moved out, so
Oh, has it? I didn't know
we could
that.
start a GoFundMe page and
Make off with the money. Yeah.
make a, no no
Oh, sorry. I mean, yes.
yes we could
Start a Beatles
start a
museum.
Beatles museum. Yeah.
Well, here's what I read. There's a chap who posted on the Steve Hoffman forums, a guy called Mike Carrera, who posts lots of things on there and is very informed and an interesting guy. But he was saying that the concert that came out last week is 38 minutes and 34 seconds long, but the actual longest version of what happens on the roof, that it's actually more 46 and a half minutes is actually the length of time from when they stepped out onto the roof to when they stepped off the roof. So there's a couple of seconds here and there of reels being changed and things being edited, but there is some in between interstitial noise that's still not on that rooftop concert that came out last week. And one of them is that little tiny bit of "I Want You, She's So Heavy" jam that they do. And there's a one after 909 jam that I don't think is on the Apple stream and that kind of thing.
Giles Martin specifically says in his interview, it's all there except for a few seconds of wind noise at the end that
Which is once again a lie. The you can even hear them changing the tape reel. Is it it's either right after the God Save the Queen jam or right before that. You can hear the tape speed up, meaning that they've changed the tape reel down in the control room and they're speeding it up to start again, which is not, obviously that's not out of the ordinary. And if it is lost to history, that jam or any other, thing because of the technical aspect of changing the reel, okay. But don't tell us that you just cut the wind noise, Bob. We know you didn't just cut the wind noise, And we
Well,
want to
even
hear the wind.
well, we heard Ringo's wind in on day 21, didn't we? But it is still a fantastic 38 minutes and 34 seconds. And I think what is there sounds great. The Atmos, Dolby Atmos mix sounds great. I'm glad it is finally out there. I'm still surprised that a Beatles release like that came out with literally a few hours' notice. Like, it just seems crazy.
I think they are
Reacting.
running, they're reacting, they're running to catch up. And Peter Jackson, I think deserves all the credit we can give him for what he's done. And I think Apple just need to pick up the pace, you know?
So let's talk a little bit about, why we're here today. So, William, you went to see, there was the announcement a few weeks ago, along with the fact that Peter Jackson's Get Back is coming out on three DVDs and Blu-rays with essentially zero extras unless you're into postcards and tat. But you got to see it in IMAX because, sadly, on the island of Ireland, although we have IMAX theatres, none of them were deemed worthy enough to show the Get Back show on the 30th of January, which is a bit disappointing. But thankfully, you were able to go. Set the scene for us. Where did you go, by the way?
So I went to the Regal Cinemas in Charlotte, which is about, let's see, I'll bring up my ticket here. The Regal Stonecrest 22 IMAX. Big shout out to the Regal Stonecrest. No, but it's in Charlotte, which is from my house, It's like an hour and 30 minutes from my house.
Okay.
I go to Charlotte all the time though. So it's, you know, it's fine. And I mean, obviously if it's going to be somewhere in North Carolina, it'll be in Charlotte or Raleigh. Maybe.
Whereas you know, see, but... I was going to say an hour and 30 minutes. That's a good drive to get to the cinema, but you know, you could drive the length of Ireland in an hour and 30 minutes. Not quite.
Yeah,
but,
pretty much. Yeah.
I'm a musician. I'm used to driving a bit, you know,
jumping in a car and doing what needs to be done.
Exactly. So we went down there, and I was just going to say a couple of things about the event itself. It was shown in 70 IMAX theaters in the US and then at one other theater, the BFI IMAX theater in London.
Yes, which is a very nice theater. I've been to it, and it's a great part of the world. You probably know it as well from your London travels. It sits in the middle of a roundabout.
But it's one IMAX theater in the rest of the world.
It is pretty crazy. Now, I think there is due to be a run in IMAX cinemas, but it hasn't been announced later in February. But this was the one you wanted to get to.
It has been announced. It's the 11th through the 13th.
Well, they haven't announced it in Ireland if it's coming to whatever that one is called in Dublin. Boo. Anyway.
Oh, yeah. IMAX.
That is racist. Anyway, it seems, because I read the figures today, that there was a very high sellout rate in all the theaters where they showed it. There was a gross of over $500,000 from this one night of showing the Get Back concert experience. So I'm assuming it was the same in North Carolina, where the place was full.
It was full. The two seats next to Abigail were empty. And I think that those were the only two seats, at least. And it's funny that you say that it sold out, because when we walked in, this cat in the front, you know, sort of row right there, whenever you walk in, was, you know, turned to his buddy and said, you know, most of these have sold out all over the world. They're saying they're all sold out. And I like turned and looked at Abby. I said, look at that. Hey, you know? And, but no, we had really great seats, like right in the middle of the screen. Perfect view. And so basically the way that it started was, I didn't get any popcorn, didn't get any anything. I was like, we got to be in there. I think it starts like right at 3:00. And so we went in and we sat down, and when we were sort of milling around for a little bit, there was a QR code on the screen. Beatles Get Back and then QR code. And it so of course I scanned it, and it took you to a landing page on your phone that said, your location, what theater you're seeing it in, your name, and then what question do you have? So that's when I texted Steven and I said, quick, answer me right now. I'm here. Yeah, I'm here. Look, you know, and so, but you could only submit one question. And so I had submitted my question, which did not get answered. I mean, it got answered, but they just didn't say William's question from Charlotte. my question was like, what was your favorite, you know, unearthed thing that as a Beatles fan you'd never seen? And but he goes on to sort of talk about that. But yeah, and so then all of a sudden the lights went down, and then up pops on the screen Matt Everett, who I don't know from the radio. I unfortunately have to admit that I have in the past listened to another Beatles podcast.
Oh,
there are other Beatles podcasts?
Really? I don't
know. Only one. There's one other one. Mm-hmm. I've liked him as a guest on that particular podcast before. And it was funny because as soon as he started talking, I was like, I think that that's Matt Everett. And then he said, hi, this is Matt Everett, and we're coming live to you from the BFI IMAX. And so, so it was cool. They had this whole stage rig set up. I'm sure you guys have seen the pictures.
I saw the pictures. Yeah, he's in London. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, he starts diving into Welcome Beatles fans and you know, the 70 IMAX theaters and blah, blah, blah stuff. And then one in London, there was someone behind him whenever he said like 70 theaters in all across the US. And then this one in London, like someone behind him like rolled their eyes, the one theater in England. But yeah, and so he started, you know, giving some information, and then they welcomed Peter Jackson from a Zoom call from New Zealand. And so Peter Jackson comes on and he starts talking, and you know, they're sort of making pleasantries and just really, you know, you can tell that he is really excited about, you know, this situation, that it's finally going to get a showing. And he just keeps, like, he thanked the IMAX team a lot. So then they started going into questions, and I didn't exactly write down every question that was asked, but a few highlights that I did want to just touch on from Peter Jackson. First of all, I got to say, fellas, every time this man gives an interview, is it just me, or does every time this man gives an interview, he just drops some subtle nugget that like blows my mind, or like he drops something new every single time?
What it's I've fantastic. Noticed, he's a super fan. He's totally tuned into the material. But what he's been doing throughout all of this, and from the reports I've heard from last night, he did it again last night, is he's kind of saying, you know, there's more of this stuff.
There's lots more
of this stuff. And there's you've more. No idea. And it's almost like he's one of those guys who's kind of blinking a message to the audience to somehow get him saved, get him rescued. But that's kind of the general gist of where he's coming from, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I think so. I think also he's not, yesterday he did way more than blink.
Was this in response to a question, or did he just sort of offer it up himself?
So one of the questions that was really good was, you know, sort of towards the end, and it was like, he had talked several times, or there was a question maybe a little bit, you know, halfway maybe or something, where someone said, was there any difficulties restoring the footage, and is there anything that you didn't restore, either because of quality or, you know, and he said, we restored everything, and it was pretty much easy to restore everything. And then he starts talking about the stuff in Twickenham and how it's dark. And he said that one of the more frustrating parts was that with the low light stuff, as you can imagine, when you're bringing that and, you know, whatever sort of restoration technology that they have to do, you know, supplementing frames, algorithmically supplementing frames for, you know, to bring it to 4K or whatever, like the smoothing of the shadows, a lot of the, which I mean, obviously everyone who's seen it, you can tell just from a visual perspective, it's so much more fun to watch episodes 2 and 3 because they're bright rooms, or it's the rooftop, you know. Someone asked him, did you interview anybody that was involved in the process, you know, in preparation other than Paul and Ringo? And he said, we interviewed hundreds of people. And then he pulled up his iPad to show the screen. And the first time was pretty early on because, well, I'll get to that. But the second time he pulls up his iPad and he shows a never before, like, you know, 5-10 second snippet of a never before seen interview with Ray Dagg, the cop
on the 18, roof. Yeah.
Yeah. 18-year-old cop. And, you know, and he's like, well, back then, you know, it's just, you just got to do your job. And it just couldn't go on. That's how I felt, you know? And like everybody laughed, you know? And, but so he's like, and there's more of this when we've got all these interviews and we filmed all of them. And we did, he said that they did hours and hours and hours of interviews with Michael Lindsay Hogg. And like, you know, I mean, he could not have been more, you know, gracious and, you know, with his words about Michael Lindsay Hogg. He was just like, and one of the questions was, you know, how does compiling this footage differ from directing fictitious footage, or you know, compiling it that's already shot. He just he went on and on about Michael Lindsay Hogg, like what a great job with all this footage that he's done. And you know, we have him to thank for all of this, and I'm just the guy that inherited it or whatever.
Well, it's interesting, the thing, just to stop you there for a second, when you talk about the hours and hours of interviews, because my impression of Peter Jackson, and I'm no cinema expert, Stephen, but is that he's a whittler, you know what I mean? That he starts big in his movies, and he gets them down to what he wants to get them do. So he takes these things on that are huge in scope. And it does make you wonder, was there a point in time when Get Back was going to have talking heads interviews as part of the project?
No. He said specifically, he said at no point, he said, we did all these interviews for the historical context and for, you know,
posterity, really.
Posterity. And really, I'm paraphrasing, but the specificity of intention and purpose.
Right.
They wanted to get, he talks about with Apple, this was one of the really interesting points. He said that when they sent the tapes over, there was a bunch of stuff that was mislabeled. Like he said that they had kept the footage in good condition. And so, you know, they were able to restore everything. But when they got all the rushes from Apple to their studio in New Zealand, he said that there was stuff that was labeled day 14, but clearly the contents were day 15.
Right.
And, you know, and the clapper said, you know, day 15 or what time, you know, and stuff like that. And so he said that, you know, their goal not only was to produce a movie, a documentary, whatever, but also to improve upon the archive for Apple. And he said now Apple owns all of this stuff. And whenever he was talking about all of the interviews, he said, and this is the big nugget. He said, all of these interviews would be great material if and when Michael gets to release his re-release of Let It Be on DVD. And he said that, and I was like, okay, he said that out loud. Okay, so like it's a thing that it exists, you know what I mean? And then he kept talking about it and talking about more stuff with it, and he mentioned it again and said, like I said, all of these interviews would be great bonus stuff for Michael for his DVD when that gets its release or whatever. And which I thought was a huge revelation, even though they've announced it 3 years ago, you know.
Yes, because there's no sense in all of this. There's the original Let It Be movie has just been allowed to drift off to one side, and you know, so that is big.
Yeah,
it does make sense though that everything is digitized, because obviously, you know, he's not just going to digitize the bits for Get Back. He's going to digitize, you know, chronologicalize, if that's the word, put everything in one place, get it to the point he needs to, and so it can sit on some big fat hard drive somewhere, and then he can get to whittling the movie together itself. So it's great that all of that stuff exists in a safe place, and in maybe another 50 years, some other Peter Jackson type can come along and re-edit it a different way.
Well, so that's sort of getting back to the original point, right, of what you were saying about, you know, two Beatles fans. He said, you know, there's so much here, and which he said on several other interviews, but he said it again, he said, you know, my general concern with all of this is that this stuff has been locked away for 50 years, and anything that we didn't use is going to go back into the vault for another 50 years.
Yep.
And he said, so that's why up until 2 weeks before the release, he said, I was sneaking stuff in like, oh, you know, and not to make it shorter, or he said, we kept editing and editing, not to make it shorter, but to make it longer. And, you know, and he said, you know, I'd sneak in this bit. Oh yeah, that's funny. Yeah, let's sneak that in. And oh yeah, and which really gives the impression that the length grew substantially in the final weeks leading up to it.
It is interesting because I've seen him talk in other places that there's run-throughs of the rooftop songs that he didn't include because he didn't want to reduce the impact of the rooftop. So we know there's, you know, Apple Basement run-throughs of One After 909 and all the rest from the day before. And again, you know, my one, and it's a minor complaint about the movie, is that it kind of treats January the 31st as an afterthought, you know, yeah. which kind of plays under the credits. And I get why he did that dramatically to focus on the roof, but it'd be nice to get clean, upgraded prints of Two of Us, Let It Be, Long Winding Road. And maybe that's what the cleaned up Let It Be is for. I wonder if the Let It Be that's restored and sitting on a shelf somewhere, is it restored a la Peter Jackson where it looks nice and bright and shiny? Or does it still have, is it just a cleaned up version of like a first generation print? Do we have any idea of like whether he restored it himself?
I don't know for sure. The short answer. I would say, if you've restored all the footage and all the footage is there, all the audio is there and it's all restored and everything is in a Pro Tool session or a Premiere session, Final Cut, whatever.
Yeah.
Then you just, okay, let's look at this shot from the original Let It Be. Let's just pop that over. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like
that'd be like a total remix.
Yes. Just reconstruct. You could reconstruct. Yeah. But the original film was prepared for a release a number of years ago. And Michael Lindsay-Hogg said he did the director's commentary at that time. So there is a version, but, you know, technology moves so fast.
Well, my knowledge, my memory is that we got Let It Be Naked instead. It was around about 2002. There was a bit of hubbub that, okay, Let It Be is coming to DVD, folks. And that's now 20 years ago, which seems insane. And, who knows what the shenanigans were behind the scenes, whether it was, well, if the movie's coming out, Let It Be Naked is coming out, or the album's getting, anyway, one thing led to another and we obviously never got it. So yeah, I wonder, is the restored version that version from a decade or two ago, or is it a brand new, could they totally reconstruct it? That'd be insane.
I would think that you would use this footage. I mean, I don't, you know what I mean? Like, and especially with, you know, how much he's talked about the audio component. Obviously, you know, I'm pretty big audio guy. So, you know, like him talking about the, you know, demixing in order for the film to, you know, Ringo really hitting the drums and not being able to hear it. Like,
yeah,
why wouldn't you use that on Let It Be? You know what I mean? Like, because there are portions, there are sequences of that film that are hard to watch. I mean, hard to even just experience because you're watching something and it's just, the sound is just so dreadful, you know? So I don't know why they wouldn't use it.
Did he talk any more about stuff that wasn't Get Back, Let It Be related? Did he say anything about the general Apple archive or other bits of footage?
Well, he said, so that's the, I think that's whenever he started talking, that's when he sort of turned to the camera. He said, there's a lot of stuff that, you know, I'm afraid that it's not going to be used. It's going to be locked away or whatever. So that's where, like, if you're watching, this is, I wrote down the quote. If anyone in the IMAX theater wants to see more, write to Disney and tell them you want to see more. They are, and then I paraphrase, Disney is rather reluctant or something like that. And I have no control over it. Wow. And so the least that we can do, that's the only power we have now, is the power of the public to tell Disney that we want this. And then he went on to say that he really wants to get a phone call saying we're going to do an extended cut for, you know, a Blu-ray edition or just, you know, supplemental on Disney Plus. And he said, I think that there are 2 hours, 2 to 3, no, not two. There's 3 to 4 hours of things that I would put in there.
Oh boy.
Yeah. That I think are situations that are of genuine historical significance and context and provide even more context to the film itself. And that, you know, a murmur went out over the over the audience. So, yeah, I mean, is there more? Absolutely. Is it edited? I think so. I think all it is just dropping footage in, really.
Well, I got the sense from one or two other interviews he's done in the past that he has got certain bits that are, like, as you say, it's all there on a hard drive somehow. And there's probably certain sections that are ready to go. So, one after 99 performances and some of those January 31st performances, I can't imagine he doesn't have a version of those he could drag and drop onto a screen at the blink of a hat, you know, that they weren't up for consideration at some point when this thing was being compiled. And there's obviously a bunch of, you know, if they've any full footage of any song being performed, even if you watch Get Back, you know, now you can see there are certain versions of songs and we just get a verse or two, you know, we're not getting the whole thing. And there's a sense that, well, the whole song must be there somewhere.
Lucas Hare, the, you know, friend of the show and does another podcast. He sent me a quote from Greil Marcus, and I'm not sure where it was taken from, but this is Greil Marcus said, in more than 7 hours, wasn't there time to show the group playing a single song from start to finish? Can it really be true that every time they took up the likes of My Baby Left Me or High Heel Sneakers, they just stopped after a line?
Yeah.
I think there is a lot of that. And even where, you know, I know from the bootlegs, there are full versions. And occasionally the Get Back slips into a little montage, you know, where George is singing Mama, You've Been On My Mind. And I just thought that was a very affecting moment where John is watching him, and then suddenly it segues off into something else.
Yeah. Or when Paul goes through, he starts Strawberry Fields on piano.
Yes.
I mean, it's beautiful, you know?
Yeah.
The other thing, my audio professor in college, we're both huge Beatles fans, and we were talking about it, and he said the original, like, minor sonata thing that Paul plays in Let It Be in the original film was not in the doc.
All right. Why I have to admit, I have not gone back to watch Let It Be since Get Back came out. I know that's on my to-do list, but I just have to get my VHS player working.
It's interesting that Peter Jackson is saying we have all these interviews and we have all this sort of historical context that we put together, and that would be great for Michael Lindsay Hogg. It's clear we're not going to get any of that on a, you know, a Blu-ray release of Get Back, you know, that he's sort of ruling that out, is he, by implication? You know, this is Michael Lindsay Hogg can have this, but that's not going to impact on what we're about to get.
Well, it's the thing is, typically, I think maybe in a creative way, you think, well, they're two different products, but they're two different real products made out of the same material.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, going back to just everything being in shambles, like, why, you know, when they originally announced it, they said there's going to be Let It Be, basically included in this final product. And obviously the irony is that they announced a product that then changed form many times before we got the product.
Yeah.
You know, it was supposed to be a movie, and then it was a 6 hour, 2 hour each episode thing, and then now it's almost 8 hours.
And now we have four more hours potentially.
Yeah, we said this in our Christmas episode that when they announced this in January 2019, first of all, not only was it not a Disney product, there wasn't even a Disney Plus in January 2019.
Yeah.
So the whole mode of getting it out has changed completely. And it's very interesting to see Peter Jackson do these interviews and make these types of statements, because, you know, he's a guy who seems to be a director who has final cut control, has a lot of control over his releases and his movies. And, you know, for pretty much all his career, he has decided what he wants to do. And, you know, this kind of, I totally believe that he's, you know, recutting things to make them longer, because he doesn't have that control. And he's up against two of the potentially most controlling media entities, Disney and the Beatles, people who are utterly wound up about image and getting the right thing across and controlling it and making sure. It is amazing that it has happened, you know, that we have the 8 hours that we have anyway. And, you know, maybe we won't see those 2 to 3 hours. I think that'd be a huge pity. It is amazing that he has managed to get what he has gotten out there.
It's interesting that, you know, Peter Jackson's gone rogue. You know,
yeah, that's what it feels like. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, you know, where you get those situations where a director has made something or an artist has made something, recorded something, and the record company won't put it out, and they're appealing over the heads of the record company executives to the fans. You know, let's start a letter writing campaign and, you know, let's get this released. And you think, yeah, he's up against Disney and he's up against Apple. And the relationship between Disney and Apple is interesting as well. I mean, have Apple completely ceded control of the visual project, that product? Has that completely been transferred to Disney? So they have control.
But the other thing that's really weird, Stephen, is that, you know, it's not just that. It's that most of the time, though, you know, you're talking about record companies who won't release albums. But most of the time, if a company gets a whiff of something that's successful, commercially successful and critically, artistically successful, which I think this project is, they're like, how can we milk this? How can we get more out of this? And the fact that that's, you know, I don't really think this IMAX thing is a version of that. I, you know, it seems very, you know, small potatoes, you know, and maybe there is something coming down the pipe, but they are so controlling of legacy issues, the Beatles and Disney are so controlling about stuff that if it was up to Peter Jackson, we'd have that in the shops for Christmas. We'd have the 6-disc Blu-ray 12-hour version, no bother at all, because it's ready to go. And why wouldn't they do that? It just seems bonkers.
It's funny because Jackson did say in some of the early interviews, you know, enough time has passed. Mm. What, you know, why are the Beatles prepared, not Paul and Ringo essentially, why are they prepared now to let us see this and to let us sort of have it? And he said, well, it's all become part of history. Mm. It's sort of moved on. 50 years have passed. This is all part of history. And I'm just wondering, was there a decision? Did Apple just say, well, look, you know, Giles Martin's working on the Let It Be box. This is what we're going to focus on. Just give all that to Peter Jackson. That's very nice. He's going to give us a nice digital archive when he's done. Get some money out of Disney, and then they can do what they like. They can take the risk. And maybe there was a genuine sense. I mean, as William says, you know, this product changed many times before we got to the 8-hour version. But maybe Apple just thought, well, there isn't a market for this, and physical product isn't what people want anymore. You know, they're not really that interested.
Disney tell the lie that suits, don't they? You know?
Yeah, I mean, that totally misjudges their audience and their demographic. You know, I mean, I think to both of your points about just, well, what's the point in withholding anything? It's like Mark Lewisohn has I think he said it on this podcast, like I when I go, my whole archive is going to be available.
Yeah.
And just like the Beatles need to put everything out. Like they're just like, what are you waiting on? You know, are you waiting on the 100-year anniversary? Like all of the people that would buy the product are going to be dead. So it's like,
yeah. And for a company who are putting out 100-quid box sets every year, to say that there isn't demand for physical product, they're just choosing the lie that suits. It's very political. You know, in terms of what they're trying to and what they're trying to do and put out. And I think Let It Be, they should have done some kind of crazy 60 CD. If they wanted to do mail order, people would have paid easily 1200 quid for that kind of thing, you know.
Definitely,
and they
yeah.
would have just taken the whole archive.
But do you, I genuinely think that Apple is still reflecting the negativity that has existed since 1970. You know,
I don't know. I think they think the Beatles are precious, and they are precious, aren't they, Stephen?
But no.
they're saying that, you know, we can't just open the doors because it'll ruin the legacy. We have to curate. And actually, now that we're on the post Peter Jackson Get Back era, I think you can actually say, do you know what? You could kick open the doors. It doesn't matter anymore. It doesn't matter. The legacy is totally fine.
End of part one. Intermission. End of intermission. Part two.
I know it's a bit of a hobby horse about, you know, the disappointment box, but I think there is such a holding back in the Let It Be audio box. You know, it's unforgivable because it's also one of the most bootlegged periods.
Yeah.
So most people who would buy the box have heard the tapes. They've heard the Niagara reels. They know what's out there. They know there's little nuggets in between all of the sort of aimless jamming and what have you. they had the potential to do something spectacular with that box. But at the same time, they were saying enough time has passed that we can let Peter Jackson have all the footage and we can kind of give him control. And, you know, it's passed into history. But at the same time, they're holding back.
And yeah.
It'll be interesting to see, you know, what's the next box?
Yeah.
Is it Revolver? Is it Please Please Me? Is it the Star Tapes? Will the experience that they're living through at the minute with Get Back, where people are kind of pushing them ever, you know, towards releasing more product, maybe they'll never get away with this again. You know, they'll never get away with a sort of make weight box set. You know, people aren't going to be satisfied after Get Back, the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to to Jason's question earlier of, like, you know, is there some sort of overarching plan to, like, put all of this stuff out over the next 12 months, like, you know, to fill the gap that they didn't sign the Parlophone until 62? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You know, do they not want to put out the Star Club tapes? You know, like, what's the plan? And if they're gonna, I was talking to a buddy of mine, also a listener of this podcast, yesterday. Hey. after I saw it, Josh Earls, shout out Josh.
Josh, how's it going?
But we were talking about it, and he said, you know, they're just like Peter Jackson said, it's like, you know, Disney is very concerned about money, but I find it really hard to believe that they don't see a path to you know, monetarily capitalizing on this. I mean, it just, for something that has so many outtakes and so much footage and so much material, and to put out an initial Blu-ray release that has nothing but what's yeah. on Disney Plus. Like, Peter Jackson said that during the Q&A, he said, you know, what comes out in a few weeks on DVD and Blu-ray is literally exactly what you see on the streaming service. So, you know, and that's whenever he said, you know, I would love to do an additional 3-4 hours or whatever, and like do a director's cut, put more material in there that we have. And, you know, I mean, I still have it queued up, and, you know, I mean, the first time he pulled up his iPad, he showed us how they wanted to sync everything, every camera. So, you know, it's like the start of One After 909. And so they, you know, time aligned it. And he's got 10 on the iPad screen. It's got like 10 squares, and they're all
so he can direct it live.
Yeah, basically. And so whenever they're in the edit, he said, you know, there was the reason that for the interview portions, there's still other screens going is because he said, you know, George could be doing a nice little dance, and, you know, like, Beatles fans want to see that, but also, like, you know, they'd also want to see the interview or whatever. So that's why they did it that way. But you think he has, you know, an app I don't even recognize, like the UI of on his iPad that has all of this footage. I mean, just living on this metal slate, and he's just, you know, puttering around Wellington, New Zealand. Like, you have to imagine that he's got this locked and loaded, ready to go.
I'm sensing the makings of a great heist movie where we have to get Peter Jackson's iPad. That'd be my main plan. We just distract him with a Hobbit or some crap.
Okay, so new plan. That's what the GoFundMe is for, is to fund our heist movie.
To go to New Zealand, we got to get that iPad. There is a larger philosophical question here, which is totally off the beaten track of what we were talking about today. But the question is, should the Beatles as an entity, likenesses, recordings, everything, sell up lock, stock and barrel to an entity like Disney? Like, we need to think about the Beatles in 20, 40, 60 years time, when the living custodians will not be there to manage it. And that is a very, we are currently seeing the great sell-off of music copyrights, of writing copyrights, of identities, you know, Bing Crosby's identity and all this kind of stuff. The Beatles must be the jewel. And, you know, you kind of think, oh my God, a corporation could just take over the Beatles and they become this brand, like Star Wars has been taken over by Disney, you know?
Well, can I ask a clarifying question first?
Well, I am making this up as I go along, William, but continue.
Well, the question is, does Disney just have the distribution rights to this footage, and Peter Jackson's Wingnut Productions is the creative? I mean, they have been hired to be the creative team to compile this. Then they go to Apple and they say, "Hey, can we use this?" And then Apple says, sure. And then they go to Disney, and then Disney says, no, it has cursing in it. You can't put it on our platform. Like, you know, I mean, like, so is that the hierarchy, you know?
Yeah. My understanding is that the ultimate owner is Apple. Apple owned all that footage and record tapes beforehand. Jackson is the production company, and Apple were making this project with Jackson before Disney signed on. And if you look at the credits, it seems to be that Apple own it. It's purely owned by Apple. So I have no idea whether the rights revert after 12 months or 12 years or what it is, or whether Disney have certain rights, as we said, you know, the imaging or the licensing of, you know, that Get Back rooftop image of them, the four backs to the camera and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. I don't know. But my understanding is that it's, at the end of the day, it's owned by Apple.
Sure. I mean, I think the supplemental question then becomes like, okay, well, do they also own the distribution rights of the Let It Be movie? Do they also, you know what I mean? Like, that's an open-ended question that really dictates, I think, a lot of the answers that we're looking for in terms of why was the disappointment box so bad? Why did the new, you know, rooftop concert just go up on Friday? Like, is that a Disney decision? Almost certainly, yes. But like, you know.
But somebody does have deep pockets. You know, how much would it take? $1 billion? $2 billion? To say, give me it all. And, you know, I own the Beatles likenesses, the Beatles name, the Drop T logo, all the recordings, all the movies, I own them. And I'm going to milk them.
We don't have that money, Jason.
Are you sure?
That's what the GoFundMe is for now.
This is a constantly shifting goal.
This is why we're putting this on Acast Plus. We just need a few more subscribers in order to take over the Beatles. We're covering a lot of ground here, so let's bring it back on track. Have we covered most of what Peter Jackson revealed before we headed into the movie, or were there any other major headlines?
I have one more thing.
Okay.
And this is a joyous thing. This is not a complaint. I love this. Someone asked him about Giles and his the IMAX experience itself that we were about to view. If they're, you know, something to the effect of how different was it to make this for this format or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And he said, really, like, the best part is like the sound of this. And so he said, there's actually not, so IMAX has a specific sound mixing, like codec and list of specs, which I actually looked up, but we can go over that later. You have to have like be in a specifically IMAX suited sound mixing room, you know, post-production room, in order to mix this. And he said, you know, there's not even an IMAX theater in New Zealand that I could go to view this and to edit it on. And there certainly, if there isn't even an IMAX theater, there certainly wasn't a mixing suite, for us to go through. And so we sent it to the UK, and I asked Giles if he would remix it for IMAX, and he said sure. And he said, and this is a great bit for Beatles fans, and I love this as a Beatles fan. Matt, do you know that there is one IMAX sound mixing suite in the UK? And Matt, can you take a guess where that is? And so I'm going to ask you guys the same question. Unless you already know the answer, but
I'm going to guess Abbey Road.
Yeah.
Okay. So Matt Everett also guessed Abbey Road, and I turned to Abigail and I said, "It's probably at Twickenham." And you can, it's probably at Twickenham. And then Peter Jackson said, "No, it's at Twickenham."
Amazing.
And I was like, "Yes!"
Did you stand up at that point? Did you?
I was very pleased with myself. I definitely. He said, "I just love that little bit," because you know this whole project started at Twickenham, and now the whole project ends at Twickenham.
That's wild.
Yeah, isn't that wild?
That's absolutely wild. I didn't know that. Yeah, it's all connected. It's all connected in the Beatles universe.
Yeah.
So then at that point they just tip into showing, they introduce the movie in IMAX, and what I've read is it's the exact same. There's no difference in edit or anything like that.
It starts with the ridiculous intro. That is from the original movie, which is not inherently ridiculous.
Do you mean the 10-minute potted history from part one, is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I have to admit, I love that. It's just like, you know, if you don't have time for the Beatles anthology, it's a ridiculously compact 10 minutes, but it hits all the right beats.
It does. I just think the thing that makes me laugh about it every time I watch it is I'm sitting down fully knowing that over the course of maybe that day or the next few days or the next several weeks that I'm going to go through 7 hours and 48 minutes. You know, and they felt that they needed to put in a brief history of the Beatles to people that don't know who the Beatles are, but they're consciously sitting down to watch 7 hours and 48 minutes. Yeah.
I know exactly what you're saying, but I do think it is effective because if you're trying to get that second wave of people who are saying, "I'm going to see what this is all about," I think you do actually need that 10 minutes to frame it. And he frames it very much in they were huge, they stopped touring, Brian died. Brian died is the big message that he pushes out a lot throughout that introduction and all through Get Back. So it's interesting. Okay, so then they just show that, they copy and paste that from the start.
So it starts with that, and then it goes to, I think that they moved a little bit of stuff around to say, and then they had all these sessions, mm-hmm. and then bam, it's January 30th and we're here. And then it opens up on, you know, the London streets. And there's that one shot that during the Q&A, he talks about he loves all the stuff from the street because it's so rare. It's, mm-hmm. it's really ahead of its time in that, you know, back then we didn't have reality TV. If anything was on film or on television, it was very scripted. And it was, you know, zany and or whatever, you know. And this is like such an interesting look at what just random passersby, what a London street looked like in 1969.
Yeah.
And he talked a lot about like the time machine thing. So it starts out with those, and you know,
it's the London street in 1969 is very drab. you have George in his wide lapelled pink pinstripe suit, and you think if he had just walked out of the Apple building and round the corner, everyone else is dressed in kind of trench coats and very dull, and it's very drab, and you just presumably you just got a glimpse of the peacock Beatles as they got out of their car and went into the building. It's like it's a different world once you get behind that door,
except for that one lady in the lovely red coat that turns and looks up.
Yes.
But
somebody on Twitter identified that as his mother.
Yeah, that was his mom. Yeah.
That was insane. That was insane.
And what was, well, this is a brief aside, but yesterday there were a bunch of people that went to Savile Row presumably like people that were in the movie. No, or
yes, there was a couple that were into of the interviewees. Were photographed outside, sort of on the steps or in front of the door. So they'd been there 53 years before and been sort of stopped in the street by, you know, I was there in 2019, and we stopped the traffic. There were a couple of hundred people, just standing around, and it was freezing cold, absolutely bitterly cold. But Paul didn't turn up, so
yeah,
it's too bad. He was over at his offices, you know,
where I should have been.
You had just come from not seeing him there. But yeah, so then it's street, and then, you know, it shows those street views, and there's like the yellow and blue, like ice cooler truck
van,
like, turns left, and then from there it just starts with the opening shot. I will say it's that same upward view of Savile Row, and it says, you know, and it after it, you know, sets the scene with all the street stuff, it, you know, pans up and says the Beatles, Get Back, different font than in the, you know, Disney Plus thing, and then the rooftop concert, which is the font that they've been using on all the, you know, promotional stuff, the red, you know. Yeah. And then it just sort of starts, and it started with George Martin walking in and seeing
the camera.
Hidden camera.
Yeah.
Which that's another, I feel like I'm this whole time going through it, I'm going to go back to, you know, remembering different things from the Q&A, but that's, someone asked what one of his favorite moments was to be like unearthed, you know? And he says, I'm there's so many, but one that like brings me particular joy is the hidden camera and the fact that we get to see the hidden camera. And he says, as a director, you know, you can do hidden cameras in paintings or in photos on the wall and, you know, create a false, you know, false wall or whatever and put it in there. And he said that their solution to this hidden camera thing, you know, for Michael to have the foresight to put it in the lobby, he said their solution to this was basically the equivalent of a garden shed that they brought in and they painted it all white. And it he said is the most conspicuous hidden camera in history. It's just totally ridiculous.
But the thing is, again, the people didn't have the media language at that time to even expect a hidden camera would be there. So, you know, the cops wouldn't have been expecting a hidden camera to be there. George Martin does that little sly smile at the hidden camera, which is very funny because he knows that something's afoot. But, you know, nobody was that savvy or sophisticated for that type of thing back in 1969, you know?
Right, yeah. And so then Glenn Johns walks in and he goes downstairs and, you know, it's the whole bit.
It's the whole sequence. And I guess, you know, obviously Paul comes out and they kick off and they kick in. Sound-wise, from the IMAX experience, definitely worth the money and time.
So, I mean, Paul comes out, they get ready and he hits that one bass note. Yeah. And Peter Jackson said, like, you know, when he hits that first bass note, it's really exciting, especially in this medium. And the thing was, the whole Q&A was stereo. I mean, it was just right in front of your face. And then when the movie started and everything, they were, you know, you could tell that they were probably placing some of the Nagra things in in a couple different height channels within the IMAX. So, you know, you kind of got the gist of it, but then all the like talking, all the dialogue, you know, Michael Lindsay Hogg, like, you know, put that one over there, you know, like whatever, like all of that's like general, you know, generally stereo and it's not, you know, anything. And he hits that first bass note and it hits like a ton of bricks. Yeah. And you know, a little murmur went out over the audience. And then they all get up there and they all, you know, it just goes into Get Back, that first little bit of Get Back. And it was amazing. It almost made you like jump out of your skin because it was immediately a different experience. It was immediately loud and
No one has heard it like that before. So that's the first time it's been heard in that format. Yeah.
So that was incredible. As they started to play, I think one of the best parts about the sound is once again in the Q&A, he said that a myth that he learned about that he was glad to dispel or was, you know, dispelled, is that word? Dispelled? for him was that, you know, they were tiny little amps and, you know, it really wasn't that much of an imposition on the surrounding area and it wasn't that loud, which, I mean, obviously we can hear that audio from the recorder on the street. It clearly was loud, but he said it was loud as hell. Like I learned it was very loud. You could really, really hear it. They had it cranked. And those amps, by the way, they're not small. Like they're using you know, prototype Fender either deluxe reverbs or twin reverbs at that point. And I just borrowed one a couple months back that's a 71, and it just turning the knob to 2 or 3 is too loud for this apartment. Way too loud for this apartment. So, and you know, in 69, like they had it cranked. So so it's, you know, and that's one of the things about the mix, I think, that was just really, really, really fantastic was, you know, on Disney Plus, whenever they go to that wide shot from across the street, and they, you know,
they
clearly,
yeah,
they've mixed it as if it was that far away, you know, for a split second or whatever. They did that a lot. And what was amazing about it was that, and to go a little audio nerd real quick. I'm going to read. So this is the IMAX like specs, like from the IMAX website. IMAX already has a proprietary immersive sound format in its theaters, which consists of 12 channels of sound, 7 of them at the bass level and 5 above. Mm-hmm. Unlike Atmos and theoretically DTS:X, the IMAX format is entirely channel-based and does not use 3D sound objects, so what that means is, like, during the film, there wasn't a lot of motion from an object. So, like in Dolby Atmos, you can, you know, you have the beds, and then you have objects, and so you can swirl it all around and everything. Yeah. But the cool thing about this mix was the mix was pretty stationary, but it was really, really associated with the camera. And even the depth of the camera. So not only did it really, really sound like it was like we were listening to it from across the street, but, you know, during Get Back, either Take 1 or Take 2, they do that really close up on Paul's face, and it really gets close up. Like his voice in the mix gets really, really close up. And, you know, there's that one part where they zoom in on George's guitar solo. And that gets really, really close up. And so
they're pulling the sound up to match the...
Yeah, like they're pulling it both... think of it two ways, like amplitude, loudness, but then also spatial front to back. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when the camera is like right on Paul's face, the vocal is also right in your face. You know what I mean? And then, you know, and so on and so forth. So it's really far back from across the street, whatever. And that was, it was really amazing because, you know, I know it probably sounds really cliche, but it really felt like we were there, to be honest, because the mix was just so fantastic, genuinely.
I guess when they get to the end of the rooftop gig, as you say, it's the same edit as the movie. Do they then just roll the January 31st credits and performances as well, or was there anything different
they do.
About that?
Oh, okay. They do. One thing I wanted a point of contention, and just like from my experience watching it, you know, we spent a lot of time on this talking about the potential for new material. And I went into it being like, okay, this is 90 minutes. The rooftop concert, like they just released, is what, 38 minutes.
Yeah.
So cool. And then they started the intro and I was like, okay, well this knocks out a good portion of that 90 minutes there, pal. Yeah. And then initially probably, you know, third, you know, 20 minutes into the film itself, including the intro, I kind of got the gist that, like, okay, there's probably nothing new. I was pretty disappointed.
Yeah.
And then I was like, just like sitting there. I was like, okay, so like, I can't be disappointed. I have to sit here and like appreciate the reason that I'm here, both the communal aspect of it, which was really great.
Yeah.
I mean, just during the Q&A, someone from our theater got a question asked, and everybody started cheering. It was like, you know, so and so from Charlotte, and everybody started cheering. And so that was super cool. And all the funny moments were, you know, 10 times funnier.
Yeah.
You know, because people, you know, just watching it in a crowd, you know.
I think there was a question before, when this was announced, was it going to be a different edit? I think there is scope for, as much as I do like the audience Q&As and questions, in the same way that we got a straight audio release of the gig, I think I would like a straight rooftop edit of the gig at some point. Again, the mythical Blu-ray extended edition could be a place for that, you know, but I think there is, that would be something I would like to see.
Well, that was definitely one of the things. I know a lot of people in the original edit, whenever I, you know, with the street interviews, I really enjoyed those in the original edit. I know a lot of people did not, because it distracted from the thing. And that was another point of contention for me, was going to the concert. It's the entire rooftop concert in IMAX for the first time. Look at this, you know, and they just released the full audio where there's no interviews.
Yeah. I thought it would have made sense for them to be two of a kind. Maybe there'll be a DVD CD combo with an unvox popped rooftop version in black and white. Who knows what they might do.
It was just really loud too. So, you know, I saw someone online say, you know, they turned down the, you know, interviews, and, you know, it was a little bit better, but it was like even more overwhelming, because it's like this really great and very loud mix, and then you're like, you know,
they woke me up from my sleep,
you know, it's like piercing, you know.
Well, you're making us feel quite jealous, Stephen.
It's interesting, because I was looking at people tweeting last night, and they were all saying the same thing. It was so loud. It was, you know, incredibly loud. And then someone today was pointing out that there were complaints at Old Compton Street police station, which is behind, you know, they were facing away from, that's in Soho. So that's quite some distance away from the rooftop. And Terrence Stamp, the actor, you may know him from Superman, William.
go on.
Terry and Julie from Waterloo Sunset, allegedly, but apparently not. He walked away from his acting career on the same day. So he just kind of left London, went off to some Indian retreat. And he talks in his autobiography about in Piccadilly, leaving his apartment block and hearing echoing across the rooftops the Beatles were playing as he got in a taxi and walked away from his successful film career. And you think, it's
blimey,
you know, it must have been, all of central London must have been able to hear that, you know. I have an audio question now that we have someone with an ology in audio. Why is there no wind noise?
So that, yeah, I mean, it's the
baffles, isn't it?
The stockings. I was trying to think of the European word for it. The stockings, and that was another thing I didn't know that Peter Jackson said during the Q&A, was that you know, obviously Alan Parsons Project, you know, he's like one of Glenn John's you know, assistant engineers, and I think he was up on the roof. And I think he really is probably, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, is there any footage at all of Glenn on the roof before the gig?
I don't think so. At the very, 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 very start? Briefly, at some point, I'm trying to think, does he appear?
Maybe, but
I know there's that main picture of himself and George Martin down below starting the tapes.
Yeah,
but I've somehow a mental image of him fleetingly on the roof. I could be wrong.
We'll have to go back and
we'll have to go to the IMAX and go see it all over again.
but Alan Parsons, Peter Jackson told a story. I don't know if this is a common knowledge or not, but it wasn't to me. They had sent Alan Parsons out that morning to get stockings from a local women's boutique, and very embarrassingly, what Peter said was very embarrassingly for Alan Parsons was that the shop attendant said, "And what size do you wear, sir? What size do you need?" And he said, "It's not for that. It's for something else." To answer your question, though, it is quite frankly a miracle that there is no, because what's it? It's like 40, 41, 43 degrees on top, plus wind.
Yeah. So, you can see Lennon's hair. You know, you can see the wind is there, and there's not a whisper on those mics.
But it's a crack team, like Chris Thomas, Glyn Johns, Alan Parsons, and floating around.
George Martin.
I was also saying floating around as some sort of, you know, missionary without any particular office is George Martin, the whole recurrent theme throughout Get Back, watching it throughout the month. What I find really curious is the Beatles and Glyn's relationship and the Beatles and George's relationship. And George is very much a trusted facilitator. I'll come in, I'll fix that. And the Beatles and Glyn, it's a little bit abrasive, you know, don't tell us what to do. And he's telling them what to do. Really, really interesting. And no doubt Glyn did a great job at capturing that sound. But those four guys are the best in class. Like when you think about what George had done already and what the other three were about to go off and do, amazing, amazing group of people to pull that off.
Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, did you notice the there's a little clip of Mal with his hammer on the roof?
I didn't. No.
So you see, that's another thing you have to go back. I only noticed that last night when I was watching it. Mal Evans is on the roof with his hammer ready to go. I didn't see the anvil, but the hammer is there. And you think, were they seriously thinking they might do Maxwell Silver Hammer?
They should have done, I know why he had the hammer. They should have done, I Want You, She's So Heavy. Sorry, who you were saying, William?
I know why he had the hammer. Sorry.
Why did he have the hammer?
At the beginning of the film, Ringo says, "You nailed me down in the wrong place."
In the wrong place.
That's why he has his hammer.
There you go.
So in case the wind blew the cymbals over, or...
Because I think that's a real concern, and I mean it's a real concern, especially considering a flimsy drum set in 1969, and B, Paul jumping up and down on the boards.
Paul jumping up on the boards is so funny. How can you drum on that? Like, how can you do anything on that? But particularly, how can you drum?
You are nailed down to it.
Jeez, absolutely wild. Yeah, that is the joy of Get Back. I think we'll be watching it for years to come. You just go back to it. I'm trying to figure out my next listening experience, my next viewing experience. It might have to give it a few weeks or months, and then I'm going to try and get a proper
sound. But it is one of those things where you're constantly going to be seeing. Like, I only noticed last night when I was watching it. I watched the sort of 15 minutes in the lead up to the rooftop, and they're running through Don't Let Me Down, and the camera is behind Billy Preston, and just suddenly the camera starts to move to the right, and you just see Linda's leg, and she's like one finger just tapping away on the organ during Don't Let Me Down, and I thought, there, she's rehearsing for Wings.
It's Wings, it's that Beatles and Wings combo.
There were a couple of those things I noticed yesterday during it. There's a glass of beer over John's like left shoulder that's on the road case that has all of George's guitars. There's a glass, it's towards the beginning, the glass of beer is half full, and like two songs later it's empty. It's like whose beer is that? When did they drink it? Why didn't they show that?
why do we not have audio of that beer being drunk? The other thing is, George is intensely serious on that rooftop gig until the end. Every time, you see Paul and John John is just enjoying himself. Paul is beside himself. He is ecstatically happy.
And then he sees the police and he's so happy.
And George is over there in the far sort of right-hand corner, concentrating, being very serious until Mel switches the amp off. And he kind of then, when the amp comes back on, he kind of...
He's indignant that the amp is switched off. And he's no, you don't dare. He is kind of in the moment.
There was. I think it's They May Be Parted, that who've been doing the kind of, you know, day by day, and they said all it took for George to get engaged was for somebody with more power and more authority than Paul to say you can't do that, and then George immediately, you know, okay, well I will do that, and you know,
well I think in their joy really came across in the showing yesterday. And I don't know if that's because it was a concentrated experience, you know, where you're going, like, cause going from, I mean, even just to watch the concert on Disney Plus, you have to go, you know, halfway through the episode or whatever. I will say to your point of George being serious, I think he's very nervous at the beginning. He's super, they're all very nervous. That's why the first take of Get Back is not, really that good. They're probably very cold. They're probably not warmed up because it's lunchtime. And I know I'm not at
And George
lunchtime.
Didn't want to go on the roof. And afterwards, he didn't want to go back onto the roof. Like, George is probably the least willing participant. I agree, that's what he said.
Yeah. I think he does, he relaxes during take one of Don't Let Me Down when John flubs the lyrics.
You can see him laugh.
One of my favorite parts of the whole concert. And then afterwards, you know, they're down in the thing and, you know, he's like, what's the law that says you can't do that?
Yes.
You know, and they're just all laughing. And then they show the part, you know, of John flubbing the lyrics and
George laughs again. Yes.
Yeah. And it's George that says, let's get all the rock groups. Where will we go tomorrow?
Let's
get all the rock groups in the whole world, all in London, like, you know, playing the same thing. And we'll...
It's a gift that keeps on giving. So, in short, you think you'd recommend it should be seen in IMAX if anybody has any opportunity to get to an IMAX screen.
For the sound, for sure. And I mean, you know, it's kind of like I talked about earlier with Peter's frustration with it being, you know, sort of grainy. It looks fantastic. There are only a handful of shots. There's a long shot from across from the other rooftop. There's a long shot that I was watching it, and like Paul and George and Ringo look kind of blurry, but then you look and it's like it's been smoothed out, but then the focus is actually on John. I thought that was, you know, pretty, so, but it looks fantastic. When it gets to the big, you know, big screen, and then they've got like three on the side or whatever, like that, you know, that kind of stuff looks amazing. And, but yeah, I mean, I think in terms of the experience, it's amazing to see it with other Beatles fans.
Yeah.
In a theater, as much as it's probably on parts, but fellas, it's probably the same thing as going to a Nothing Is Real live show.
That's what I've been saying for a long time.
You just love something so much and you get to experience it with other people.
Just kissing ass. Well, look.
So we need to go and say we need to find an IMAX. We need to build an IMAX. We need to get to an IMAX, and we need to get there with other people. That's
yeah. The best bonus part. I didn't even tell you about the bonus part. So we were walking out, and there was like a line to get out, and I was like, did they like lock us in here? What's going on? And so, like, you know, enough people like shuffled forward. And we, you know, I was like, what are we waiting on? And there was a cat outside the door with a table, and he's passing something out. And they were, and people were like, oh, there's posters, there's gifts. And I said, because, you know, my girlfriend and I were like, we gotta, you know, get some dinner, really hungry or whatever. And then they said posters. We're like, well, we gotta stay. So we like we get in line, and they hand out this little ditty.
A little lanyard. Backstage pass type thing, yeah. Lanyard, yes.
The lanyard, definitely the best part, the best, one of the best gifts, I think. And I like the little VIP. For those of you who can't see this Zoom call, it's a VIP pass type thing with a Beatles Get Back the Rooftop concert lanyard, which is pretty cool. And then they gave us also.
Where is that poster? Dig it out. Where is
it? You got a free poster.
Look at that.
Free poster. And then my girlfriend was like, should I get one too? And I was like, absolutely yes.
Of course, you need several.
eBay, here I come.
Yeah, we will get several. And then they passed out this little card thing, and it has a QR code for the disappointment box. But I have two of them, and if you scan this code or use this code, you get 10% off the box set on Beatles.com. So if you guys want to buy it, you can get 10% off.
I get 10% off. Okay. So,
yeah.
So we've been joined on the podcast today by William Henson, VIP.
VIP, yeah, absolutely.
It's official. He has a badge.
Well, we should thank you so much, William, for all your time and for doing that for us and being our roving North American correspondent, which is great. I suppose it's time for the William Henson promo minute, which is you've got a new single out called Social Fitness, and I'm assuming there's an album on the way.
Yeah, that's a fair assumption. Yeah.
Ooh, secretive.
Yeah.
For anybody that hasn't heard it, they should you know, do the Beatle thing and go and listen to your version of Eleanor Rigby.
That's true. Or go listen to William's song, George Harrison, which I think is how I first encountered William, because it came on a Spotify playlist a year or two ago. And
this is that I regard this as the unofficial Nothing Is Real alternative theme song is George Harrison. So
I agree.
But everything is available. WilliamHinson.com is kind of the base website, and you're on all the streaming services. And we can thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And from the sounds of things, Stephen, we've really got to get to an IMAX.
We have.
Yeah. I want to say just real quickly, like, thank you so much for having me on. I discovered this podcast very, very early on, and it was totally out of the realm of possibility to be on. So when Stephen asked, I've told everyone I know. So I'm gonna be on the pod. And so
there you go.
I really appreciate
three new
it.
Listeners as a result of of that. That's
really that'd be exactly. Fantastic. It's a pleasure, and thank you for everything you do for us and spreading the word and being an apostle of the podcast. We really appreciate everything. But that's about it for now, Stephen. I better do the spiel. We're available in all the usual places, at BeatlesPod on Twitter, www.nothingisrealpod.com, the website, which is the portal to all the other stuff. William runs the Instagram. That's what he sounds like.
Yay.
Ray. And, all the other stuff is there. Nothingisrealpod.com is where to get a portal to all that. I want to thank all our Acast Plus subscribers and supporters for helping us put Nothing Is Real together. Season 6 is on the way, isn't it, Stephen?
Well, I hope so.
Something's going to happen. It's going to be great. It's going to blow your minds. And we're getting Peter Jackson to do a very long version of it. It'll be great.
Perfect.
But for now, that was William Henson. Thank you, William.
Thank you, guys.
And my name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thank you for listening.